First of all, welcome to the Global Strategy Forum Fringe meeting. I might, just before I say a word or two about Global Strategy Forum, announce, as I've been asked to, another meeting tomorrow, not of ours, but of the Conservatives abroad in Washington, D.C., on the title President Obama or President McCain, who should a Tory vote for? Which is quite an interesting question, because none of us are going to have the chance to do so. But interesting intellectual exercise, and that is tomorrow at 9 o'clock till 10:30 in Austin Court in Cambridge Street, in the Lodge Room. So, if any of you are interested, I think it might be. Oh, just to tell you, speaking, Bill Barnett, who's the chairman of Democrats Abroad, Ed Cox, who's the chairman of the McCain campaign in New York, who's actually President Nixon's son-in-law. The Right Honourable Francis Maud, and Brooks Newmark, who is a whip. So it's quite a good lineup, and I hope some of you will manage to go along. But as I say, welcome to Global Strategy Forum. For those of you who don't know us, this is a think tank I started about 2.5 years ago when I came at my own request off the front bench in order to try and replicate something that we do find in the United States, which is think tanks that aren't just doing research, but which actually are a platform for people to come and make what I hope are interesting and provocative speeches, debates, and so on. We meet at least once a month, except in the month of August and September, in London, the National Liberal Club. We are non-party. We have board members from all the main political parties. And if you would like to be on the list of those who are alerted to what is on, please let Jacqueline Jinks, who's the director standing at the back of the room, know on your way out, and you'll get an email letting you know what the programme is. We try to vary it. It's on international affairs other than Europe, because there's so many others doing Europe, we decided not to, and on defence matters. So we have a very broad spectrum, and I hope that some of you will feel that you would like to come in the future. But I'd like to welcome you all here very much today. I'm pleased already we've had to have more chairs brought in. You never know at these fringe meetings how many people are going to want to come to them, but I think we have got an interesting topic for you. Much of this conference, as I think we all know, is going to be about the economy and about social and environmental challenges, what you might call, on the one hand, our broken society, on the other hand, what we all think might soon, if we're not careful, become our broke society. Today we wanted to look at something rather different. The international challenges in the world, which we normally concentrate on, are the very obvious ones of water shortages, of food prices, and of energy. And those are ones, again, which we are going to have to address over the months ahead. But there is one underlying issue which very rarely now gets the attention which I believe it needs, and that is the threat of confrontation. For all that when the Berlin Wall fell, we believed that we were going to see the dawn of a new peaceful era, what we do know now is that that is not how history has ever worked or how human nature works. Confrontation, sadly, is part of the human story, and I think will always continue to be. And when we speak of confrontation in our age, we do so in the context of an increasingly nuclear world. We're not talking just about conventional confrontations, but we're talking about the constant threat that there might one day be a nuclear confrontation. We're not just talking about proliferation in Iran and in North Korea. We're also talking about the growth in the number of nuclear weapons, the nuclear weapons that might eventually become available to other non-states or rogue states or terrorist organizations. And so we are looking at something where we are facing a very real issue, not a theoretical one, and real to the extent that when I was Shadow Foreign Secretary in 2002, I saw at pretty close quarters how very nearly the aggression between Pakistan and India tipped over into a military confrontation which could well have ended up with nuclear arms being used, and they had no nuclear doctrine to prevent it. And it was really seeing that that made me begin to think very seriously about what we should be doing as a party, as a country, in terms of nuclear weapons. 3 years ago, I heard a speech in London given by the United States former Senator Sam Nunn, and he was talking, rather to my surprise, about the need for nuclear disarmament. Not unilateral nuclear disarmament, but the need for an integrated and international long-term initiative, first of all to reduce the number of nuclear weapons and eventually to get rid of them altogether. And the point he made was that we don't live in a static age, and we never have. The number of nuclear weapons are either going up or they're coming down. And at the moment, in his view, and I think his evidence is correct, the number of nuclear weapons in the world, as well as the number of states who are trying to become nuclear, is actually going up. And so there is now a need for positive action. And that speech struck me very forcibly, to the extent that I began to think seriously about our own nuclear weapons. I believe in the current climate that we do need to have our nuclear deterrent, and I make no issue or bones about that. But I also believe that we should be part of a process of civilized nations leading the world in reducing and eventually removing nuclear weapons and the threat of nuclear war, not on a unilateral basis, but on a multilateral basis. And it was on the basis of that thought that, rather to the surprise of some of my colleagues in Parliament earlier this year, I did not vote for the redevelopment of the Trident programme in 15 years' time. While I accept the need for a deterrent now, I believe that for us to actually start committing ourselves to a new, stronger nuclear deterrent in 15 years' time was giving the wrong message in a world where we need to really be looking at how we can persuade people to go the other direction. And I know that my view was not universally shared by my colleagues. Indeed, in the speech following mine, my colleague here, Malcolm Rifkin, told me how profoundly he disagreed with me. He may well do so again today. But what I hoped to see was a positive initiative involving the great countries of the world, ourselves, the United States and others, who would work to decrease and dismantle rather than increase and strengthen the world's nuclear stockpiles, particularly as it is no longer technologically difficult for others to develop nuclear weapons. And we don't live in a world anymore where we have to wait for the AK Khans to sell their technology to countries. You can actually get it off the internet. So we live in a world where we really do have to take action now. And I was delighted when I read that in America, four very senior figures had come together to try and create this initiative. They were Sam Nunn, I was talking about earlier, Henry Kissinger, William Perry and George Shultz. And together they formed the Nuclear Threat Initiative to develop steps for achieving a world free of nuclear weapons. And I was further encouraged when, following that, both Senators Obama and McCain endorsed that initiative and said that they believed too that this was the right way forward. And indeed Michael Howard and myself, among others from different parties, sponsored an early day motion in Parliament giving our support and endorsement to that initiative as well. But really the high point for me came when at the end of June this year, in the Times, there was printed a long article signed by four very distinguished politicians in this country, which was also endorsing this initiative and calling for action upon it. The four senior politicians were Douglas Hurd and David Owen, both former foreign secretaries, George Robertson, who was a former NATO Secretary General, and another former foreign secretary, my old friend and colleague, Malcolm Rifkind. Malcolm is with us today, and in this party he doesn't need any introduction from me. He's one of the, if I may put it this way, the big beasts of our party, who has contributed greatly not only to our party but to the fortunes of our country over the many years that he has been involved in politics here. And I'm going to invite him to address us, after which we will take questions and comments on what I think is a question which inevitably at the end of the day affects us all. The question which we've set is a little ironic. It is, might 12,000 nuclear weapons be more than we need? And that is the question that I'm now going to ask Sir Malcolm Rifkin to answer.
Michael, thank you very much indeed, and thank you for inviting me to speak today. You began by announcing a meeting tomorrow on the American presidential election. I heard recently one of the most splendid gems to come out of this campaign. Before Hillary Clinton stood down, Chelsea Clinton, her daughter, was campaigning on her behalf. And she went up to someone whom she didn't realize was a Republican and said, "Will you support my mother, Hillary Clinton?" And he turned to her and said, "Ma'am, there are three problems in this country. The first is Osama. The second is Obama. And the third is your mama. Now, enough of these matters. Michael, in his introductory comments, referred to the problems we are facing in the United Kingdom of a broken society, or is it a broke society? I thought we've had such miserable news that I thought I'd cheer you up today with nuclear weapons and the possibility of nuclear annihilation. It seemed to be a suitable alternative to the current gloom. Perhaps I ought to begin by saying, what is my entitlement to have a view, or everyone is entitled to have a view, but to comment on these matters in this way. When I was Defence Secretary between 1992 and 1995, I was involved in the new Trident submarines that were being brought into service, and I remember when one of them was going through its test firing near Cape Canaveral, I was invited to join this submarine for several hours. And after the successful test, we had several hours going back to Cape Canaveral, and in the captain's wardroom, in this huge submarine under the seas, there was the captain, three British admirals, two American admirals, and the Secretary of State for Defence. And guess which movie we watched? Mutiny on the Bounty. I also had a rather curious experience which puts these matters in perspective, because some months later I was asked by the Ministry of Defence, would I take part in a nuclear war game? For those of you who don't know, quite often, in a very serious way, there are what are called war games, where the military go through what might be a real event in order to see how they would react and how people would behave if it was the real thing on the real day. And they said, Secretary of State, if you could like to join us for the latter part, it would be enormously helpful to have the Defence Secretary, because that would be what would happen if this was a real event. And so I joined them, rather sceptical about this. And it was actually very, very gripping, because the scenario was some rogue Middle Eastern state that was threatening to use some weapon of mass destruction against the United Kingdom. And the question was, after all the various other steps had been taken to deter them, might we have to threaten to use our nuclear deterrent? And at one stage, and I got carried away also with this tremendous atmosphere, and at one stage, the generals and the admirals turned to me and said, well, Secretary of State, we really think we must ask you, are you prepared to go to the Prime Minister and ask him whether he is prepared to give authority to the possible use of our nuclear deterrent in these very special circumstances? And just I was required to give some sort of view for the purpose of this exercise. Just as I was about to respond, the division bell went. And I said, gentlemen, the question of nuclear war will have to wait. The whips want me to go and vote in the division level. So they were rather unimpressed at this destruction of their exercise. One very final preliminary comment, and it's a very sobering comment. I think the fact that I recollect with great clarity was when I became Foreign Secretary. In the first couple of days, I received a message from Downing Street, from the Prime Minister, saying that, and this was the normal procedure, although I hadn't been aware of this before, that in the event of there being some grave national emergency threatening the very security of the United Kingdom, if the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister, Michael Heseltine at that time, if they were incapacitated, unable to be approached, then I, as Foreign Secretary, would have to take that decision, would actually have to take that responsibility. And I have to tell you, that is a pretty sobering thought. Now, this was after the end of the Cold War. There was no serious likelihood of that happening. But when you realize these are not just theoretical questions, that in a given set of circumstances, you might actually be the person that might have to take such a ghastly decision of that kind, that brings home to you these issues. Now, let me make another general point, if I may. The issue of nuclear weapons and whether we should have some element of disarmament in our policy has often been thought of as a sort of left-wing policy. This is about CND, and it's what the Labour Party used to believe in and all that sort of thing. As Michael rightly said, that was unilateral disarmament. And at the end of the day, whether you're a right-wing Tory, a left-wing socialist, or anything in between, none of us have a vested interest in nuclear war or in these weapons ever actually being used, and the world being destroyed as a consequence. So we all have, whatever our political philosophy, whatever our political ideology, we all have the same belief that if there is a need for nuclear weapons, then we must ensure that they are kept to whatever is the minimum required to achieve the objective. And at the same time, we must try and ensure that wherever possible, alternatives are developed to deal with the political problems that the world will always face till the end of time. So that, I think, is an important point to bear in mind. And when Michael read out, as he rightly did, those in the United States who have launched this initiative saying we actually have far too many nuclear weapons in the world, far more than are required for the legitimate purposes of deterrence, and it's getting worse, not getting better. It is significant that of the four signatories to that article that Michael mentioned, one was George Shultz, who of course was Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State, and the other was Henry Kissinger, who was Richard Nixon's Secretary of State, two Republicans of the highest authority and with very robust views on a whole range of international issues. So we're not dealing with a right-left issue. We're dealing with the fact that the world is moving on, and it is appropriate to look at the world as it is today, and can we be comfortable and satisfied both with nuclear weapons and with the number of nuclear weapons that exist in our planet, on our planet at this moment. Now, when you think back to the Cold War period, that was a very different situation to the one we face today. During the Cold War, you not only had competition between the Warsaw Pact and NATO, between the United States and the Soviet Union, there was a great global campaign for supremacy in terms of capitalism, in terms of democracy, the whole way of life that we had. And because there was always a possibility that the Cold War could turn into a hot war, and indeed during the Cuban Missile Crisis and over the various crises over Berlin, some moments we were not hugely far from such a reality, then inevitably the question of nuclear weapons was linked to the Cold War and the need to resolve it in a satisfactory way. And remember also at that time, the possessors of nuclear weapons were the prime actors in that Cold War. There only were five nuclear weapon states. Only four to start off with: the United States, the United Kingdom, the Soviet Union, and France, and then China subsequently. There weren't any others. So those who had nuclear weapons were those involved as the prime players in the Cold War. And we are now in a very different situation, because although we have problems with Russia, Russia is not going to be fighting an ideological conflict. There's no global war for supremacy going on. And Mr. Putin is not a new Lenin. He's actually rather like an old Tsar, trying to extend Russia's influence, but not having the remotest interest in the kind of global ideology that motivated the Communist Party in the Soviet Union for so many years. So it's a new situation. What has happened since the end of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War? A lot that has happened has been extremely good in the nuclear field. Over 13,000 nuclear warheads have been destroyed, have been dismantled, have been removed. They no longer exist. And that is hugely impressive. And what was also impressive, I say that was of course mainly the United States and Russia, because they were the possessors of most of them. But in the case of the United Kingdom has made great strides towards trying to reduce our nuclear capability to the minimum that is consistent with our overall defense policy. And so, for example, we have got rid of what used to be called free-fall nuclear weapons, the Hiroshima kind of weapon that you drop from an aircraft. We've got rid of tactical nuclear weapons, or these are much smaller nuclear weapons, still hugely devastating, but which could be used on a battlefield. We have made very major reductions to the number of warheads that our Trident submarines carry. They're now down to 160. Far, far less than the capability of the Trident system. And France has, in different ways, also made moves in that direction. So that has been very, very encouraging. It has also been interesting that, at least in the earlier years, the problems of proliferation, of new countries becoming nuclear powers, it was going in the right direction. The one country that has given, that had nuclear weapons, and that gave them up completely, was South Africa. South Africa was developing them before the end of apartheid and actually possessed a small number of nuclear missiles, nuclear weapons, warheads. The new Nelson Mandela post-apartheid government completely got rid of their nuclear weapons capability, and that is remarkable. But what is also remarkable is that, of course, when the Soviet Union collapsed, many of their existing nuclear weapons were in Kazakhstan and in Ukraine and Belarus, which could have held on to them. But these countries, all three of them, managed to cooperate with the complete removal of all nuclear weapons on their territory. So that is pretty good news. And Libya, of course, which looked like at one stage trying to develop a nuclear or WMD, weapons of mass destruction capability, has been persuaded not to do so. That's the good news, and that's very much to be welcomed. But you know, there are current concerns, and they're very huge concerns. We must not ignore them. First of all, there are too many nuclear weapons. I mentioned that 13,000 warheads had been destroyed. Do you know how many nuclear weapons there are in the world at the moment, operable, that could be brought into operation? Over 12,000. And every single one of those 12,000 nuclear weapons is about 50 to 100 times more powerful, if not more than that, than the bomb that blew up Hiroshima or Nagasaki. So we not only have 12,000 of these, 95% of them in the possession of either the United States or Russia. They each have roughly 5 or 6,000 each. But there's another 10 or 12,000 which are held in reserve, which are not operable at the moment, but which in certain circumstances could be made to be. So we start off with a vast number of nuclear weapons, infinitely more than can possibly be required for any legitimate purpose of defense. You don't need to be able to destroy the world several thousand times in order to be able to protect your own citizens. And that, in a nutshell, is why people like George Shultz and Henry Kissinger and Sam Nunn and others in the United States, of impeccable right-wing points of view, have been, as well as from other aspects of the political spectrum, have been saying this needs to be acted upon. And it's not simply a question of numbers. It is also that the more weapons and the more fissile material you have around, the more likelihood that some of it will end up in the wrong place. Some nuclear warheads went missing recently in the United States. They went missing for 36 hours. They'd been loaded onto an aircraft, and I don't know the precise details of exactly what happened, but it has been acknowledged that for 36 hours they did not know where they were. Now, no harm was done. But you know, if that can happen in the United States, imagine what could happen elsewhere. So that is part of the concerns that we inevitably have. But also, of course, proliferation. Because as we have seen since the end of the Cold War, new countries, particularly India and Pakistan, possibly North Korea, and in the slightly longer term, but not that far away, Iran, become real question marks of a very serious kind. The problems about a country like Iran having nuclear weapons is not just, although that's very important, the threat to Israel. It is that if Iran has nuclear weapons, do you imagine all the Arab states, who are the traditional enemies of Iran, are going to simply say, well, that's okay, Israel has them, because Israel has nuclear weapons as well, although it doesn't admit it. Iran has them. All the Arab states can do with that. So you are seeing the potential process of proliferation of a very, very serious kind. There is another problem, of course. It's not just rogue states like North Korea or Iran. It is also the fact that there are now not only terrorist organizations that would like to get their hands on dirty bombs or missiles or weapons that could have devastating consequences. But these are precisely the people, if they are the terrorists from the extreme Islamist background, who are not going to be interested by deterrence, because actually they are anxious to meet their maker as soon as possible, as long as it's in the right circumstances. The Russians throughout the Cold War had no greater interest in blowing themselves up than we had. That is true of the Indian government, it's true of the Pakistani government, it's true of all the existing nuclear powers. But if you have weapons either in the hands of a government or of a terrorist organization, which consists of people with a, as we would see it, a bizarre fanaticism, totally unconcerned about their own mortal lives, then the risks become infinitely greater. So there is a need for action. And the problem, in some ways, is getting more acute. We have seen, and Michael mentioned this in passing, the what became known as the AQ network in Pakistan. Now, this was the guy who actually was the father of the nuclear bomb in Pakistan, who quite illegally, and without, so far as we know, the approval of his government, sold some of these nuclear secrets to the Libyans, to the North Koreans, to the Iranians, about how they could enrich the uranium and how they could develop their own nuclear capability. So there are serious problems to be addressed. I think that the question I want to now move on to in the second half of my remarks is this. Are we simply talking about seeking to reduce the number of nuclear weapons, or is there actually a case, one day, for seeing the elimination entirely of nuclear weapons? And is that possible? Is that compatible with the kind of world that we live in? Nobody, certainly nobody of a responsible background, would ever commit themselves, I believe, to unilateral disarmament. The world is too dangerous, too violent a place, too difficult and unpredictable a place for ever that to be justified. So the question is, could it ever be safely contemplated that we could not simply have major reductions in nuclear weapons, but actually see nuclear zero and a removal in their entirety of nuclear weapons? It depends really on several questions. Any disarmament at any level, in order to inspire confidence and not panic, first of all, it has to be verifiable. You have to be certain that people are carrying out the commitments and obligations they have undertaken. And therefore you have to have a whole series of inspections, of checks, of access, of transparency, to know that those who have committed themselves to reducing or eliminating weapons are actually doing that. And there are already very sophisticated systems, but as you will be aware, they don't always work. So that requires hugely more effort and work that has been done so far. But secondly, it's not simply a question of verifying that people have got rid of their existing nuclear weapons. Are they going to be able at some future date, without telling you, to recreate them? Do they have still fissile material, even if it's not in the form of a nuclear warhead, that in a space of a few weeks or a few months could be turned into a nuclear weapon? And if they don't have that fissile material, do they have the capability of creating it, partly through civil nuclear installations that are primarily meant to deal with nuclear power stations, but can be properly misused? These are very difficult questions, but there is an additional one. Margaret Thatcher once said, and this was during the Cold War, she said, a world without nuclear weapons would be less stable and more dangerous for all of us. And what she was saying, that sounds in a sense rather paradoxical, but she was saying in the context of the Cold War, and it was during the Cold War of the Soviet Union she was talking about, that actually without the possible threat of a nuclear war, both the Russians and the West might have started a third world war many years ago. We already had two world wars beginning in Europe. Who knows, perhaps it was the discipline of knowing that any third war started in a conventional way might then escalate to a nuclear exchange and destroy our civilization on both sides of the equation. And there was a powerful argument that she was making, and she was broadly right in that judgment that she made. Even today, there is an argument that the Indians and the Pakistanis, who have been to war with each other several times over the last 60 years, since they both acquired nuclear weapons, both are showing a degree of caution, a degree of discipline, a degree of concern, a more constructive approach to resolving their problems than in the past, because the risks of nuclear war resulting from an escalation of conflict are just too terrible to contemplate. So it's not a bogus argument. Is it, however, a valid argument? Are we able to say that as a general principle, what applied during the Cold War, that the balance of nuclear weapons prevented any war happening, is that a principle we can apply to the world as a whole? And I have to say to you, my own judgment is that no, we can't, because we do not have throughout the world the kind of discipline and the common desire for self-preservation that existed between the Soviet Union and the NATO countries during the 50 years of the Cold War. If Iran has nuclear weapons, if Pakistan collapsed into internal either anarchy or with some extremist government of an irresponsible kind, then are we really saying that those nuclear weapons would not be even more of a threat, even more of a risk to the welfare of mankind as a whole than if they did not exist in the first place? So I don't think we can live with a world that says on a, as a sort of general principle, nuclear weapons well worth having because they prevent conventional wars breaking out Yes, that may have been true when nuclear weapons were held by a very small number of relatively very mature states. But if we see the proliferation of North Korea, of Iran, of Pakistan with an uncertain political future, and with possibly other countries joining the same bandwagon, then the idea that somehow we are safer with these countries having nuclear weapons than if they did not is almost impossible to maintain. So what conclusion do I come to? It is basically this, that you can have a short to medium term objective, and you can have a long term vision, target, aspiration. Don't conclude that because you cannot achieve everything at once, therefore there's no case for any change at all. There is a powerful need as we speak for some very serious and major changes to be made as regards nuclear weapons in our world. First of all, there are too many. And as I said a few moments ago, there is no need. And most people are in the United States political world are either agreeing with this or are acknowledging its force. There is no need either for America or for Russia to have roughly 5,000 nuclear warheads. They could have 1,000, 700, 800, whatever. And their basic security would not be in any way jeopardized, particularly if each was doing it and each was carrying it out in a comparable fashion. So that would not only be important in itself, because it would reduce the number of warheads and it would reduce the problems that are associated with it, but it would also actually set an example for the wider world. Because, you know, increasingly, many of the non-nuclear countries are saying the deal that was made when the non-proliferation treaty was signed was not just that non-nuclear countries would not acquire nuclear weapons. Part of the treaty was that as part of general disarmament, the nuclear states would also move towards a non-nuclear future. That was part of the treaty that we signed, the Americans signed, and others signed. It doesn't commit us in the sense of this year, next year, the year after, but it is increasingly being seen as double standards for the West to be saying that the Iranians and North Koreans and others must not have nuclear weapons, but we're damned if we're going to make any change to the situation as we see it in regard to our own defense. So the non-proliferation treaty next coming under review in 2010, that's only 2 years from now, and I think it's going to be important for Western countries to demonstrate that without removing our nuclear deterrent, we have seen whatever reductions can be made that show the direction that we wish to go wherever that is responsible and sensible. I think the second factor is to ensure a far greater control over fissile material, a kind of material that can then be enriched and used for nuclear warheads. And there is a real issue about whether those countries that want civil nuclear energy, nuclear power stations, how they're going to get access to the enriched uranium, and whether there might be a case for having some central repository of such material under effective control, if that can be done, and that's easier said than done. But that could be under central control and then could make available where the material was required for legitimate purposes of producing energy, the enriched uranium that was needed. I think the final point that I want to suggest is that, of course, one of the issues dividing the United States and Russia at the moment is this question of ballistic missile defense. The American policy under President Bush of establishing at the moment in Poland and in the Czech Republic facilities that might be used to intercept any attacking missile, not from Russia, there's no suggestion of that, but from the Middle East, for which read Iran. And the Americans have argued that they need these facilities. The Russians have been deeply angered by these facilities that are being established right next to their own border and see it, in fact, as an undeclared threat to their own security. I think both the United States and Russia, and I say this with deep regret, I think both the United States and Russia ought to be thoroughly ashamed of themselves on this particular issue. Yes, the Americans are right that one day there could be a ballistic missile threat from Iran. It's nowhere remotely going to happen, at least for a good few years to come. There is no threat of that kind that could threaten Europe by the Iranians, at least for another 5, 10, 15, 20 years. So to create a crisis today is unnecessary. But the Russians, for their part, have grossly overreacted, because the kind of facilities the Americans are establishing are not missiles themselves. They are interceptors that would simply knock down an aggressive missile that might be coming from that direction. And, you know, if there is a potential threat of missile attack from Iran, then Russia and Europe share that same risk. And there ought to be, as has been acknowledged in Washington and elsewhere, there ought to be an opportunity for the closest cooperation between Russia, the United States and the European countries for a common strategy on ballistic missile defense. That, there's no reason why that could not be achieved if the political will was there. So I conclude by saying there is a need to recognize this is not just an invented issue, it's not an exaggerated issue, it's a real issue. One day, who knows, we might be able to get the kind of transparency, verification, political will, trust that will enable nuclear weapons to be completely phased out. And the world would probably be a safer place, in fact almost certainly would be a safer place, if that could be genuinely achieved. But I conclude, as I've said before, that in order to actually make the kind of impact required, we need real progress over the next few years, reducing the existing number of nuclear weapons, removing the ease with which some can have access to fissile material, dealing with this immediate problem of ballistic missile defense, and that way we can ensure a safer world for ourselves and for generations to come. And it's, you know, it's something that isn't going to go away. The quicker we address it, the better. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. And I think, I mean, the importance of this initiative, and I think Malcolm reflected this today, is it isn't just aspirational. People in the past have talked about the need to get rid of nuclear weapons. This is an initiative which is trying to develop step by step the ways to achieve this over a period of time. And what Malcolm has outlined today are some of those steps. And that's why I think it is so important that we actually support it, and I'm delighted that it is getting the breadth of support it is. Before I open it, I just want to make two comments. One, Malcolm was talking about Pakistan and India, and I said earlier that I'd been quite close to that potential conflict at the time. I went there just after it had been decided there would be no conflict, because Richard Armitage, the United States Assistant Secretary, went over there, and I'm not sure it was the occasion he threatened to bomb them back to the Stone Age, but he used words of sufficient force that they decided that it was better not to go to war. But I was told by the Pakistanis that they had always refused to sign a no first strike agreement, because the only purpose of them having nuclear weapons was if the Indians overran the line of control, after 11 days they would have no way of stopping them other than by nuclear weapons. So it was a real threat. It was not just the conventional type of deterrence. A week later I was in New Delhi and I spoke to the defense secretary there, a man called George Fernandez at that time. And I said to him, did he realize that the Pakistanis would have used a nuclear weapon 11 days after the Indians had crossed the line of control? And he said, yes. And I said, well, what did you make of that? And he said, we have 1.1 billion people. We can absorb a nuclear strike. Now, that was one of the most chilling comments I've heard. And it is very different, if you like, to the theory of mutually assured destruction. There are countries who would not see a nuclear strike as being the major disaster that it would be, for instance, if it happened to this country. The second thing is that deterrence only works if two things are there. One is that the people who you might deter are fearful of that deterrence. And many of the people who are threatening us today, as Malcolm inferred, are people who actually do not fear death. And death, in many cases, is part of their cause of martyrdom. And therefore, deterrence would not really be very effective against them. The second is the credibility that the country, whether it's us or America or another country, would use that deterrent has to be there. Because if the person you're trying to deter doesn't believe would use it, then it is no deterrence. And those are questions which I think are still very real, live questions in the current international situation. We haven't got answers to them, but hopefully they might generate some of the discussion today. So I open it up now to the floor, people who'd like to ask a question or make a comment. Gentlemen, started.